Thank you. Oh,
Allison and Teray, they cut me off.
I know. I saw your lips moving. I kind of knew what you meant.
She was trying to speak.
Thanks, Rachel.
You're welcome.
Hey, so it is Friday. So let's take a look at the headlines that made up the week in Iraq. Get it. For this 253rd week since the start of the conflict, General Petraeus is staying put. That's the word from Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
The president is pretty clear that he wants General Petraeus to stay right where he is through at least through late fall and maybe the end of the year.
Now, the announcement ended speculation that the top U.S. commander was exiting the post to become the next NATO commander in Europe. Iraq has a new flag. Iraqi lawmakers voted to remove three stars that symbolize the Ba'athist ideals of unity, freedom, and socialism, as well as Saddam Hussein's handwritten calligraphy of the phrase, "God is great." The phrase remains only in another font. Now, on the ground, a large bomb blast hit Mosul, killing 34 people and wounding at least 224 others. The next day, a suicide bomber killed Mosul's police chief and two others as they toured the devastation, prompting Iraq's government today to announce they're launching a major offensive against al-Qaeda in that city. And today, the New York Times is reporting that, quote, with its international mandate in Iraq set to expire in 11 months, the Bush administration will insist that the government in Baghdad give the United States broad authority to conduct combat operations and guarantee civilian contractors specific legal protections from Iraqi law, according to administration and military officials. So with an eye towards the future, we turn to journalist Jeffrey Goldberg. In this month's Atlantic Monthly, he investigated the unintended effects of the Iraq War and how, in the coming decades, it could all change the landscape of the entire Middle East. He spoke to more than 25 experts and traveled to Iraq. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. So your article is long, so I'm going to try to get to some of the main points.
I don't think it's long enough.
It really is an article that could keep going. But one of the main unintended consequences of the war is that you write very early on the article, and it's a great history lesson, because you said it really exposes how tenuous the map of the Middle East actually is.
Right.
Remind people how Iraq's borders came to be in the first place.
Well, you know, Winston Churchill and a couple of English bureaucrats dreamed it up one day. It's amazing the long-term consequences of people's tea time chats. But essentially, after World War One, the French and the British were tussling over who should control the Middle East, and the British decided to create countries like Iraq and Jordan. The French got Syria and Lebanon. Lebanon was created at the same moment. It's incredibly artificial. I mean, all states are artificial, of course. There's nothing natural about the presence of any state on the planet. Some man had to make it. It's amazing how quickly and with how little thought the map of the Middle East was made after World War One.
And it could be an indication of what comes to the future. From your interviews, you seem to predict that Iraq could be carved again into three pieces and that the Kurds are really going to come out on top in this one. Why?
Well, it would just be a return to the way it was, because you have to remember when really quick history lesson, the British, the Allies defeated, among others in World War One, the Ottoman Empire, which controlled that whole area, the whole Middle East. What the British did was they took three separate Ottoman provinces, one based in Basra, one based in Baghdad, one based in Mosul, north, central, south, and roped it together and called it Iraq, because
right.
Why not? It was great fun to be an imperialist, obviously, because you get to play Risk, but for real. So it's completely feasible that the parts would come apart. Obviously, one part of it, Kurdistan, the northern third of Iraq, 99% of the people, according to polls, want to leave.
But it's interesting that in a conversation, was it the conversation you had with Bremer, where he said, no, we call that northern Iraq?
No, that was Wolfowitz.
Wolfowitz, sorry.
Well, you know, the funny part of that is that everybody says the Bush administration and the neocons wanted to rip up the map and cause long-term instability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, they seem to be overly committed to the flawed map as it currently exists. It's sort of one of the small ironies here.
Wasn't the map originally drawn in a way that was intended to maintain controversy between peoples who historically did not like each other?
Excellent point. I mean, because that's the classic British model. classic British imperial model, yeah, and other people too. I shouldn't just blame the French. The British, I mean, the French did it, the Portuguese did it in Africa especially. What you do is you put tribes together that don't like each other, and you empower one tribe, usually a minority tribe, to be the police, to be the bureaucrats, and that over time, I mean, that's what you saw in Rwanda, by the way, over time that group takes disproportionate control. That's what happened in Iraq. The Sunnis became empowered. They're only 20% of the country, mm-hmm. but they dominated Shiites and Kurds in much the same way that the whites in South Africa dominated blacks for so long. It's the classic model, and of course, we're paying for that model today in all kinds of ways in all different places.
Now, you spent some time talking to neoconservatives about what they thought would originally happen
right.
after the invasion and the war, one of whom is about to release a book very soon, and said that new borders were never really in the plan for them.
Yeah, you know, I was surprised at that because, look, from a moral perspective, why shouldn't the Kurds have independence in the same way that why shouldn't the Palestinians have independence? I mean, nations should be allowed to be independent and free if they want to be. And, you know, everybody said that the neocons were motivated by, well, I mean, the critics say misguided moralism or however you want to put it. But I was struck by the fact, Doug Feith is the one that you're talking mm-hmm. about, I guess. I was struck by the fact that A, they didn't want to actually break up the country, and B, they didn't think that it was a possibility. I mean, talk about unintended consequences. You know, that's what I'm always struck by is how scenarios weren't talked through. Different scenarios back in 2002, 2003. What could happen in Iraq? The idea that it would fall apart and break apart was not really contemplated seriously.
Yet they still held out hope for democracy in the area. And you confess to being an erstwhile optimist about that idea.
Oh, yeah. I'm American, you know. I think everything's going to get better. But,
well,
I mean,
what
the Middle East is
you?
A challenge to optimism, right?
Well, what changed for you? Was there one point, was there one thing that has happened in the past 253 weeks that you thought to yourself, maybe that's not going
to
work?
You know what? In Middle East history, 250 weeks, I heard your introduction, 250 weeks is a blip.
Well, that's an interesting
that's
point.
A coffee break in
yeah.
the Middle East.
But that's also an interesting point for people to think about when they're talking about the future of Iraq. We can't
this
talk about it in
started.
5 or 10
That's
years.
The point of my article is that we're just starting down this road. And, you know, and to me, the definition of what a neocon is versus a realist is a neocon has a tolerance, or maybe a vicarious tolerance, for instability. In other words, a neocon, and I hate the term because it's sort of a term of just insult at this point, but yeah. but someone who believed in this war and these ideas might say, well, you know what, if in 30 years Iraq is in a better place and we're in a better place because of it, then it might be worth it. A foreign policy realist says 1 year of instability and chaos is not worth it. We'd rather have a dictator sitting in charge and just keeping everything tamped down and quiet.
Let's make this political for a moment, Jeff. The GOP almost uniformly, except for Ron Paul, thinks we're winning in Iraq. The Democrats almost uniformly think we're losing in Iraq.
Right.
And should get out immediately. From your position, who's right?
Neither. How's that for an answer, right?
Good answer.
Probably the correct answer.
No, probably the correct answer, because the politics does infect this in a kind of way. And if the Republicans say one thing, the Democrats axiomatically have to say the other. And that's the problem of politics. I tend to think that we're neither winning nor losing at the moment. Obviously, Petraeus has done an excellent job of stabilizing things a little bit, bringing it to there's still violence, obviously. It's a civil war in many respects. But we won't know if we're winning or losing until we actually get the Iraqis themselves, the Iraqi government, to activate itself and actually try to make some decisions and try to organize the country and try to see if they can keep it together. But we're still in, let's just say we're the post-mission accomplished phase, but we're in the second phase that's gone on for a very long time, 200 weeks, let's say, or more, in which we don't yet know yet which way this is going to go. Obviously, every month that goes by where the Iraqi government doesn't take hold of the situation and make hard decisions is another month wasted.
Jeffrey Goldberg wrote all about this in the Atlantic Monthly. It's a really good article. Take some time. Check it out. We'll link through to it on our blog. Hey, Jeffrey, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you.